We're continuing in this series through the Psalms, continuing on all the way through Easter. This week we are looking at a particular hymn of praise. This psalm is also a companion psalm, and the companion psalms are Psalms 96 and 97 as well. And there are a great number of similarities between these three psalms, and a lot of times the tradition was that they would read all three songs together at times. But while this song and the other songs are of great joy there's this temptation, or maybe that's too strong of a word, but there's this reaction or response from us that we might concentrate on the nature of the praise nature of the song and only focus on that, while those last two troubling verses talk of God's judgment on us as well. And a God of love and a God of judgment sometimes seems like a mix of oil and water, which they don't mix, do they? Here in our psalm, we have phrases like, sing to the Lord a new song. And all God's people, can you just picture him crying out, hooray! The Lord has made known his salvation. And all God's people cry out, hooray! God remembers his steadfast love. Hooray! Make a joyful noise to the Lord, and God's people cry out, hooray! Shout and sing praises, hooray! The seas roar and the rivers clap their hands, hooray! The Lord comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world with righteousness and equity. And then we kind of go, oh. Suddenly we're uncomfortable, and we might be squirming a little bit in our seats. How does such praise and raucous music and talk of judgment go hand in hand? And this is the puzzle this morning. How does these two things fit together? And you could call it kind of a conundrum throughout the entire Old Testament as well. In the previous psalm, Psalm 97, which is one of the companion psalms, it says in verse 8, the people hear and rejoice. The villages are glad because of God's judgment. People are celebrating because God is coming to judge. Do you consider God coming to judge a cause for celebration? God is coming to judge, and the people cry, hooray, ooh. there's not quite as much conviction in our voices, is there? The psalm's theme this morning is one of future judgment. It's this day which is still yet to come, and it's supposed to be a time for great joy. But the question that comes to our minds might be, what could possibly be so good about a judgment day? But that's what the psalm says. When the true king comes, everyone rejoices. In fact, when the true king comes, the seas are going to roar, the rivers are going to clap their hands, and the hills are even going to sing out for joy. And they will be doing this all together, right along with the multitude of people. And by the way, as a side note, slight side note, we get these phrases in the Psalms especially, like this one. Yeah, you know, the trees clapping their hands, or the seas clapping their hands, and the hills singing for joy. And some people just call these metaphors. And I think it cheapens the Psalms, personally. I think, well, for one, there was no such thing as a metaphor back then. So they didn't think of these as metaphors necessarily, like we think of metaphor. And the more I read phrases like this, and the more I hear commentary on these types of phrases, the trees will clap their hands, or the seas and the rivers are clapping their hands, coming alive, I'm beginning to believe more and more about what's happening is that even creation itself is pointing towards something. It's longing for something. The rocks and the seas and the rivers and the trees are all becoming animated, and it's pointing to this greater reality that everyone and everything is going to experience one day in a new heavens and a new earth. It's when the true king returns, it's not just that all wrongs are going to be righted, and they will be righted. It's much more than all broken things are going to be mended, but they will be mended. It's even that the inert or latent things are going to explode into a new reality. Everything and everyone is going to realize their full potential finally. Everything and everyone is going to explode into their full capacity. And we don't know what that's going to look like, but that's exciting stuff to think. And these metaphors, if we want to call them that, are pointing to that, that we're going to see, and it should stir us a little bit, even though we're just Presbyterians. I'm also not sure how we really get this idea of King returning and celebrating, especially with the history in the throughout the world, the history of kings as miserable, largely. And our country was founded on essentially telling a king to shove off, right? And mind your own business. But we still find a fascination with the monarchy. And I'm looking at Steph right now. She loves to watch those documentaries on PBS about the history of the monarchy. But we all do, don't we? We find this certain fascination with the history of kings, don't we? And maybe it's because we all know deep down inside that for all the benefits that democracy has to offer us, it's more like just a medicine rather than real food. Winston Churchill once said that democracy is the worst kind of government out there, except for all the others. Democracy, for all it's given us, hasn't really solved any of the long-term problems, human problems in the world, though. And another person said, all democracy has really done for us is that it's made it harder for us to kill one another. Does human society long for a democracy? Or do we really long for a hero king who will come to make things right? Who is going to straighten out those crooked ways? Who is going to make those rough places smooth again? The Bible tells us that we are all built in the image of God, and if this is true, then we must have this certain type of knowledge of God built into our very beings, right? But the problem is, as Paul says in Romans chapter 1, that we suppress that. But even though we suppress it, it still resides, I believe, deep inside every individual. And what resides there is that once upon a time, a very, very long time ago, there was a king who stood on the earth, and his rule was filled with wisdom and strength. With justice and compassion he ruled, and with beauty and glory he dealt with his subjects. And this king was like the sun, shining in full strength, and everyone has something deep within them that knows that humanity was built to serve and to love that true king. And it's only under that true king will we ever truly blossom into our full potential. But it's the whole earth, as the psalm says, it's the whole earth that's going to blossom and in ways that we could never imagine right now. And we're going to discover on that future day that there's these buds in the rocks, in the trees, and the rivers that we just never knew about before. And all of a sudden they're there and they're blossoming. This true king, when he really does come back, is going to rule on the earth. And there really will be an end to evil. And there really will be love without parting. And there will really be a final escape from death forever. And the world will show forth a beauty that even the most vivid imagination couldn't come close to explaining what it will be like. You remember that movie, Hook? I think it was in the early 90s. Robin Williams, Maggie Smith. Robin Williams played Peter Pan, and Peter Pan had this problem. He was an adult now, and he forgot who he once was. Maggie Smith plays the aged Wendy Darling, and there's a crisis in the family, and Wendy Darling is trying to convince Peter that all the stories are really true. They're all true. You are the real Peter Pan. And of course, Robin Williams at this point is looking at Maggie Smith and thinking, you're nuts. It takes a lot for Peter to finally get all of his memory back because he suppressed the knowledge of who he really is. And we suppress the knowledge of this true king who will one day come back, and he will come in such greatness and glory that all the crooked things will be made straight, and even the rocks and trees and the rivers and the hillsides are going to spring forth in a way that we never knew could ever happen. And you will one day be everything you always could be, could have been. And on that day, I or somebody else is going to come up to you, and they're going to say, oh, yeah, that's the you I always knew you could be. I've seen glimpses of that you in your best moments on earth, but now it's all you, and it all makes sense now. When the king comes, he comes as a judge, and this judge will be righting all the wrongs. This judge is going to come and set things straight, and, well, how can we rejoice in light of that? How do we rejoice in the light of the fact that if this king is truly right and fair and judges over everything, that everyone has done wrong, and it all must be paid for, how do we rejoice when he comes? Who is this king? Who is the king who is returning? And if we look at ourselves, we're going to see, I'm part of the problem, aren't I? So how do we rejoice? There is a conundrum here in the psalm. The psalms is cheering for a king who is returning to set all things right, yet we don't deserve to be in the parade, do we? I'm a part of the crooked, which needs to be made straight. Uh-oh. This isn't a problem only found in the Bible, but it's a problem in the world today. The philosophers and the intellectuals are saying today that postmodernism is in trouble, or dead, depending on who you talk to. Postmodernism says there is no set of judgments, one set of judgments, and there is no one set of moral standards in which we are to be held accountable to. On the one hand, someone said this: postmodernism has led to some real-world gains for humanity. Because once you challenge the dominant discourse, you are also giving the marginalized groups their voice. So what postmodernism has done, on the one hand, is helped culture and society address injustice, right? But on the other hand, postmodernism has also says that no one group has the truth. No one group has the set of moral standards by which we should all live. It says there is no judgment to come because there is no one set of standards. There is no real straight edge by which to measure our lives with. And if there is no set of standards, there can be no judgment day, and then that means we all have equal voices, and we can all have our own freedom, and we can all have our own rights, and there's no one group pointing and knocking another group because there's no one saying you're right and you're wrong. Because no one really has the ultimate truth, right? That's what postmodernism. The reason intellectuals are saying postmodernism is over is because if no one has the position or the truth, then no position can actually be asserted. And if no position can be asserted, then everything is relative, which means I can't say certain actions are right and certain actions are wrong. I can't say certain things are just and certain things are unjust. Postmodernism runs into this wall because we accept everything as it is. And it doesn't seem like the intellectuals know where to go from here. They know postmodernism has run into the wall, but they also don't want judgment either. They don't want a king to come who has the true straight edge with him in which they can measure humanity and hold it accountable. There's also a problem with judgment in the Bible. In the Bible, God always relates to people through covenant. Covenant is binding. It's like a contract we sign today, a binding contract. And in a covenant, we make promises. And God says there's blessings if you keep the covenant and curses if you fail to keep the covenant. In the Bible, God says, I'm going to bless you and if you keep my covenant with me. In other words, obey the words of my covenant and you will be blessed. And I will abandon you if you break your promises. In other words, if you fail to live up to the words of the covenant, I will abandon you. The problem in the Bible is that every single person who has ever entered the covenant relationship with God has broken it. So what should God's response be to us? Should God just say, oh, I give in. I know you couldn't possibly keep that covenant. I know you've broken it too many times to count. I'll just overlook it. I'll give in and accept you anyway. Or does God say, you have broken my promises one too many times. I'm calling my justice in. Do you see the conundrum between love, the love and faithfulness of God, and this anger and justice of God, the holiness of God? In the Old Testament, God says these words, I will never break my covenant with you. I will never abandon you. I will always be faithful. But then he also says stuff like in Deuteronomy chapter 29, if you go your own way, my wrath will burn against you. All the curses written down are going to fall on your head if you break my covenant. And the Lord will blot your name out from under heaven. So you see these two different sides going through the whole Old Testament. Follow me and you'll be blessed. If you break my covenant, you'll be cursed. The question is does God give up on us? Or does he give in to us? If God gives up on us, then where is his love and his faithfulness? If he gives in to us, where is his holiness and justice? Are God's blessings conditional or unconditional? And that was a topic of great debate in my Old Testament class when we were studying the Abrahamic covenant. Is God's covenant conditional based on my perfect obedience to the law, or is it unconditional and given to an imperfect people? There are two spirits behind this argument, and one of them is, there's this two groups, essentially. And one is, you need to try and obey God, but in the end, he accepts you no matter what anyway. You try to obey, but in the end, he's not really going to judge you. Or, there's the other group on the other side, God loves you, but in the end, you better obey, because he's going to judge you one day. God can be merciful, but in the end, you better obey. You can call these two spirits the liberal spirit or the conservative spirit, spiritually speaking, not politically speaking. You can call these two groups the Sadducees and the Pharisees. You could call these two groups the relativists and the moralists, or the postmodernists and the traditionalists. You could break these two groups down on the religious spectrum as well. You have the fundamentalist group, and you have the average mainline denominational group. You have the Buddhist, and you have the Islamist. And we all tend to break down into one of these two groups. We say blessings are conditional and we must obey, or we say the blessings are unconditional and he accepts us. Where do you stand? Where do you stand? Because we all do lean into one of those two groups, one or the other. And it creates a big problem for humanity. If there is no judgment day, what hope is there for the world? If everything is relative, then that means everything's just going to keep going on and on. If there is no judgment day, what does it matter if the world goes in flames tomorrow or 100 years from now? If there is no judgment day and the world is going to end this time tomorrow, what does it matter how I behave? And if it doesn't matter how I behave, if the world's going to end tomorrow at this time, does it really matter how I behave if it's going to really end in 100 years from now? One day or 100, does it matter? But if there is a judgment day, what hope do we have? In Romans chapter 2, God says he's going to judge everyone. And he's going to judge the people of the world in two ways. He's either going to use his standards or your own standards. If a person does not know God, he's going to say, I'm going to be fair with you. I won't judge you by my standards. Let's look at your standards. Problem is nobody lives up to their own standards, let alone God's. If there is no judgment day, there is no hope for the world. If there is a judgment day, there is no hope for us. That's the problem in the Old Testament. And what is the answer? And the answer lies in the first three verses of our passage. And you notice they're singing past tense in those verses. He has done marvelous things. His right hand and holy arm have worked. The Lord has made known. He has revealed. It's all past tense in the first three verses. Everything else in the psalm is forward to judgment day. Commentators of this psalm say that the psalmist is probably looking back at a different song, probably looking at Miriam's song. And Miriam was the older sister of Moses. The Israelites have just escaped Egypt, and they are running away from the Egyptian army, but they come to this dead end all of a sudden. It's called the Red Sea. But God delivers them once and for all from Egypt by parting the Red Sea. The Red Sea was deliverance for the Israelites, and that same sea was a sea of judgment and destruction for the Egyptians. God worked salvation, remembering his love and faithfulness towards Israel And Miriam's song is a song about that salvation. The psalm is looking back to the Exodus, and keep in mind that God saved Israel from Egypt through judgment. God sent before that, before the parting of the Red Sea, God sent an angel of death, the destroyer. And it was the last plague in Egypt, which was a taste of what everyone deserved. Remember, the angel of death was sent to kill any and all firstborn in the entire land. Nobody was exempt. You got to remember that. Nobody was exempt. The Israelites were not exempt from this judgment. God said the firstborn in every family should die. You are all sinners, and you all must come under the judgment of God. And that judgment was the firstborn child is going to die. And it was laid out for everybody. And then God said, but if you slay a lamb and put the blood of the lamb over the doorposts of your house, the angel will not touch your house. And that's the story of the first Passover. Have you ever thought of the first Passover in that way? That the Israelites worshipped God, but they were under the same judgment as the Egyptians. Nobody was exempt. And the Bible says every human being deserves judgment. It doesn't matter if you are moral or upstanding. It does not matter if you are a church lifer or not. It doesn't really matter. None of it matters because really you are only relatively better or worse than another person. It's all relative. Nobody is living up to their moral standards. Not you or I. Nobody is. Everybody deserves judgment. Nobody lives up to their own moral standards, let alone God's. And if God is a God of justice and completely impartial, he needs to send judgment down on everyone. That includes you and me. Everybody deserves the death sentence. And there really is only one hope that we have, and that's if we paint the doorposts of our heart with the blood of the Lamb. Now, this song also is a reflection of another song in the Bible. It's a New Testament song. It's called the Magnificat, or Mary's song. And there's a lot of links to the two songs, and Mary must have been probably thinking of this very psalm that we're looking at today. And in her song, what she realized is that what she was going to bear into the world was the Savior and the true King. She realized that Jesus Christ was the fulfillment of the psalm we've been looking at today. That Jesus Christ was the climax of all the promises that they were looking forward to in the Old Testament. And we need to realize that Jesus Christ is the resolution to the problem that we have. He's the resolution to the conundrum, the problem of justice. Jesus is the solution. He's the solution to God's sense of justice and holiness, and he's the solution to God's unconditional love as well. It feels like the blessings of God should be conditional or perfect obedience, or unconditional and come to an imperfect people. It really feels like that. You're pulled one way or the other. And without Jesus Christ, you are relegated to either being a moralist or a relativist. And you would swim in that idea that God is either more holy than good or more good than holy. And we'd continue to not get it. But the cross solves the issue for us. Because on the cross, we have a judge who issues the fine towards us, but then he also steps down off the bench, takes his robes off, and pays the fine. On the cross, we see the love of God and the holiness of God meet together. It's on the cross where both sides can coincide and shine in utter brilliance. The law does demand perfect satisfaction, but on the cross, the law was perfectly satisfied. Law and love meet perfectly, and both are equally satisfied. So, class, are the blessings of God conditional or unconditional? And the answer is yes. Theology math does not add up. It never does. They are conditional, but we see that the perfect obedience of Jesus Christ fulfilled the law. And yes, God wants to bless an imperfect people, but because of Christ, he can bless you and me. And now when you believe in Jesus Christ, you are no longer flooded with the burdens of moralistic obedience, but with the benefits of God's love. Moral absolutes without Christ would crush you and oppress you, even though you really do need him. And we will use morality to oppress ourselves and oppress others. But we have a judge and a king who did everything for you. So now you can, and so how can that king oppress you when he's already done everything for you? He can't. He can't oppress you. And that is why we can sing out on that day, along with the rocks and the trees and the rivers and the seas and all that lives. And we can sing that song with as much gusto and joy, and we can cry out, hooray, because of that one day, which is still to come, when our king will indeed come to rule. And maybe we'll sing that song that this psalm is based on, or the song that was the inspiration for this song. We all know this song. It was written by Isaac Watts, and it's based on this psalm. And the words go like this: joy to the world, the Lord is come. Let earth receive her king. Let every heart prepare him room, and heaven and nature sing. He rules the world with truth and grace, and let the nations prove the glories of his righteousness and wonders of his love. And we will sing forever the wonders of his love, the wonders of his love.